You're listening to episode 101 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Chang.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Chang, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
What's up, storytellers? We are back with episode 101. And hello from Portland, Oregon, by the way. Did any of you catch the eclipse? Moonland and I were lucky enough to be in Oregon during the eclipse, purely by coincidence. We were road tripping along the Pacific Northwest as a part of my 30th birthday celebration, and we so happened to make our way up to Portland during the time of the eclipse. So we drove a few towns down south to catch the eclipse in its path of totality in Salem, Oregon. It only took about an hour to drive from Portland down to Salem, but heading back up to Portland right after, I was in traffic for about 6 hours, and it was totally worth it. The total eclipse was the most magical and miraculous sight I've ever seen. I recorded our reaction to the eclipse with my phone's voice memo app. So for those of you who did not get the chance to catch it in totality, you can get an idea of what it was like by listening to the following clip.
It's 10:15 a.m. We are in Salem, Oregon, and we're on the path of totality. It is 2 minutes away from the total eclipse. It's gotten really dark. It's getting really cold and breezy. It looks as if there's like a permanent sunset filter almost. There's like a reddish hue to the light. And yeah, it just looks so strange right now. I can see people, but it's hard to see people, I think, because of the shadows of the light. Moonland saying it looks like a super small sliver. So right now it's 10:16, 1 minute away from total eclipse. I am going to put my eclipse glasses back on. I'm looking from McDonald's. Yeah. Now looking.
Look, it's just like a little string.
Oh, people are cheering right now. Woo! Oh my gosh, we're almost there. It's this tiny little sliver. Kind of looks like a nail clipping.
Yeah. A toe.
I know, like a toenail clipping. Oh my gosh, we're almost there. Oh. Everyone is cheering, and we're at the Capitol Hill. Oh my gosh. Oh my God. What? Oh, there's a tiny sliver. And it's 3, 2, 1. Oh my God.
Woo! Oh shit, look.
Oh my God, what the hell?
Oh my God, holy. I have never seen anything like this in my life. Babe, look at this. Holy shit. What? Oh my God. I don't even know if well, can we capture this on the camera?
Let me try.
Okay, I tried taking a photo, but that did not work.
I should stop my thing.
Yeah, just enjoy it. Moonland is trying to time-lapse it, but I'm just sticking to voice memo so that I don't have to look down and I can just record. Holy shit, this is the most beautiful thing ever. Oh my God, what? Oh my God. It's 10:18 right now. Are those fireworks going off? Oh my gosh, there's like airplanes and helicopters and fireworks going off. That is the most beautiful thing ever. Hey, look. Oh my God. I have never, ever seen anything like this in my life. Oh my God.
So pretty.
The moon is completely covering the sun and it's being backlit. So the rays are coming back out.
Oh shit. Okay.
Wow, the eclipse is over. Did you accidentally look into the ray? Because I did.
Yeah, but it was worth it.
No.
my
God. Wow.
That was so beautiful and just out of this world. Yeah, I understand now.
How crazy was that? It's my wish that everyone gets a chance to watch a total eclipse at least once in their lifetime. Now on to our show. If you're new to our podcast, first of all, a very warm welcome to 88 Cups of Tea. I am so happy to have you here. I interview really inspiring and awesome storytellers in hopes the stories and experiences they share will shake you out of your funk and make you feel less alone. For all of my listeners who've been with us for a while, thank you for hanging out with us every week, and a huge virtual hug to our amazing listeners who've recommended and shared our podcast with friends and left really awesome iTunes reviews. As for updates, I just made some major changes over on our website at 88cupsoftea.com. Our website is our virtual headquarters, and I'm constantly making changes to make the site as helpful to you as possible. Head over to 88cupsoftea.com to check out the top favorite episodes from your fellow listeners. If you'd love to see something specific on our website, let me know on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at 88cupsoftea. If you're looking for a sense of family with a bunch of people who understand the highs and lows of being a writer, you should really join our private Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. I love this community of ours, and I always have the best time checking in to hear how everyone is doing. We check in almost every day to talk about our work in progress, our latest achievements, current reads, and so much more. We honestly have the most encouraging and supportive members in our group, so you don't want to miss out on this special community. Come over and hang out with us at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. Before I jump into the introductions for today's guests, I'd love to wish a very happy birthday to Mickey Shaloa, Tara Turley Creel, Jody Armsby Gallegos, Rachel Ashworth, and Kate Larking. I hope you all have an awesome birthday month, and may all of your wishes come true. Now on to our 101st episode, we have literary agent Barry Goldblatt, founder of Barry Goldblatt Literary. In today's conversation, Barry shares how he transitioned from an 11-year career in the rights and contracts departments at various publishing houses to opening his own literary agency. Barry walks us through the elements of a story that attracts him to a novel for representation, his manuscript wish list, the categories he represents, and what he's actively seeking. We discuss his relationship with clients and how he meets their needs and how he guides their work to publication. Further into our conversation, we get into the nitty-gritty of the technicalities like how literary agents match authors and their manuscripts with editors and publishing houses, and what happens to a manuscript after it's sold to an editor and publishing house. Barry also walks us through what exactly subsidiary rights are in the publishing world. If you're about to query a literary agent, you're in so much luck because Barry covers the do's and don'ts of a query letter. Now let's jump right in.
Hey everyone, I know you all are very excited. We have Barry Goldblatt with us today. Barry, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you, Ian.
I am very excited to have you with us and thank you for making the time. How was your weekend?
It was good. I was at ReaderCon, nice. Which was fun.
Where's ReaderCon?
ReaderCon was in Quincy, Massachusetts, just outside of Boston.
Fun. How's the food scene there?
Quincy itself is not a great food, although we actually found out there was a place called the Shaking Crab, which I guess is a mini chain. It was a seafood boil, so they bring you a giant bag full of crab and shrimp. It was delicious.
I am so hungry right now. Specific standard time for me, so it's 11:30 a.m. It's about to encroach lunchtime. I'm all about food. Every place someone goes, I'm like, how's the food, though?
That's my priority. Everybody knows that whenever I plan a con or wherever I'm going, the first thing I do, I don't plan anything else, but I plan where I'm going to eat. That's more important than even where I'm going to stay.
Can you imagine that's okay? Well, we can't invite Barry to this convention unless they have exquisite food, unless they have amazing lox and bagels, delicious sushi, amazing seafood. Otherwise, there he won't come. What is your favorite food?
I suppose my favorite comfort food is barbecue. Beyond that, I'm a huge fan of tasting menus because it's a chance, just like everything else I deal with, it's story. It's a chef telling me a story. I love sitting there and having these plates of food brought out that hopefully all interconnect and interrelate and tell me a story about the chef and what they like, who they are, and of course tells my tongue and my stomach a very happy story too.
I have a feeling we're going to get along quite fine. My girlfriend, she helps to start restaurants and also bars. So she's in the middle of opening up her own shop. She's okay. All about storytelling via food. And that's something I feel I've had to explain a lot to people who don't understand the food scene in that way. So
thank you for explaining it so beautifully. I'm like, yes, you can be our spokesperson. Amazing. And you just get free food all the time.
I'm okay with that.
And you're like, actually, I'm not opposed to it. Are you into cocktails?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, the cocktail scene in Brooklyn has gotten a little ridiculous. The hot thing here right now is the folks behind Alinea have opened a cocktail bar in Manhattan called The Apartment.
When did it open?
I think about 3 or 4 weeks ago.
Oh, of course.
It's
I just missed it.
It's impossible to get in. 30 seat. The reservations are booked from now until doomsday.
I'm literally writing this down. It's called The Apartment by the people from Alinea. It's amazing. I love the documentary on him. You know Pegu Club?
I do not.
You clearly need to know about this because it was the best cocktail that I've had around the world. I've had cocktails in Singapore, Malaysia, Taiwan, Europe. I've had it in New York City, LA, San Diego, and this is hands down the best, and you're lucky it's in New York. Pegu Club, it's called Martini, as in they switch out the T-I for T-E-A, and it's Earl Grey tea with the egg whites. Funny enough, those are the two ingredients that I hate, but then the bartender let me try it. Holy, I was blown away. The layers and each note stood by itself. It was a great standalone, but then put together, it wasn't like it blended in. A lot of times cocktails sometimes taste like water and you're like, where the hell is the flavor? But then this one, you taste every single note together and also individually at the same time. The bartender who made that for us, I didn't know, but he created one of the drinks that my girlfriend ordered, which was this whiskey bourbon drink with tea and cigar smoke in it. He invented that.
My favorite cocktail joint, at least in Manhattan, they have two outlets, but I prefer the one down in technically Chelsea, and that's Rain's Law Room.
I wanted to go to Rain's. It got so crowded though.
It's my favorite place to take people. It's styled on an old New York speakeasy. You know, you have to go downstairs and knock on the door to get in. The wallpaper is funky as all hell. It's awesome. I really like it.
That sounds like Please Don't Tell. I'm sure you've been.
Yes, I know Please Don't Tell. Yeah.
I feel you might like Angel Share as well. It's Lower East Side, Japanese speakeasy cocktail bar.
Okay.
They are fantastic. I'm not really a whiskey bourbon drinker, but because my girlfriend is, I get to try it. I tried her drink that she got. When you first sip, then you swallow, you taste the matcha that comes out. So it's a mixture of matcha with the bourbon, and it was exquisite. That was a great kickoff. So more about you. Why don't you tell us more about where you're from, where you grew up?
I'm an Air Force brat. I mostly grew up in the Southwest. My dad was in the Air Force. And we're not a typical military family in that we didn't move every year or two. We were a little more steady, basically every 3 or 4 years for me. Growing up, there was a lot more moving around when I was an infant, and I don't remember any of that. Fort Worth was where I went to kindergarten through, I think, second or third grade. And then we moved to Tucson, Arizona. From Tucson, I went to Sacramento, which is where I went to high school. And then after that, I went to college. So then it didn't matter where they were.
Where'd you go to college?
My first year was the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana. And that was utter misery, and I hated everything about it.
Tell us how you really feel, Barry.
This is back in the day before the internet. And before you could do research, and I didn't have any money to go visit schools. So it was just looking at catalogs. And my only criteria for school at that point was how far away is the school from my parents? That was the most important criteria. It totally backfired on me because A, this was the school I got into and went, and literally, I think a month after I accepted, my family was transferred to Lawrence, Kansas. My dad was going to be teaching at the university there. He's going to be teaching ROTC. So they followed me to the Midwest. So I didn't get that far away. It ended up actually working out very well because after my miserable first year at U of I, I went home to Lawrence. Because my dad was teaching there, I could get in-state tuition plus a faculty discount. So I think it was $600 a semester. So I originally planned I would go to the University of Kansas for a year, you know, get my head together, figure out now what I wanted to do again, and then transfer somewhere else. And I ended up falling in love with Lawrence and the university there. And I ended up getting a dual degree in English and journalism from there.
Wow. And then I fancy. Okay, so you went to New York right after?
Right after college, yep.
Backtracking a little bit, how was it like being an Air Force brat? What was that like for you? I hear there's a lot of bullying involved, unfortunately, for a lot of Army brats because it's always a new kid and being picked on. Did that happen for you or you made friends easily?
God, no, I definitely didn't make friends easily. I was an easy to pick on kid. I was A, smart, and B, super arrogant about being smart. I was a target to begin with, and the fact that I was nerdy a bit, that's an understatement. I had a mouth and I wasn't afraid to use it. I got beat up a lot. I got chased home from school a lot.
What? Barry!
There's a lot of things that as an adult you can sit here and go, wow, if I could go back and just have a little conversation with you, I could have saved you a whole lot of physical beatdowns. I think being opinionated has obviously become sort of my business, so I guess it worked out okay.
I'm sorry, Barry.
Like I said, I've certainly seen kids who had it much, much worse, and I've heard horror stories from clients and other people I know, so it would be nice if human beings could actually be nice to each other. I think, unfortunately, the beating up is being human. It'd be better if we could be better than that.
I agree with that. Much better stated. How does that affect you raising your son? We all wish we could go back and be like, hey, you individual self, you should listen to me. This is me 20 years later. Since we can't do that, I'm sure you pass on words of wisdom to your son. But obviously, we know that us as kids, we wouldn't really want to listen to our parents anyway. But is there anything from you growing up and your own experiences? Does that affect how you have raised your son and how you've talked to him to prevent these things from happening to him?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you can't help but parent from your own experience. And you try really, really hard not to replicate the things that went wrong between you and your own parents. And I think we actually did a pretty decent job on some fronts. He's had a very different upbringing. He has never lived anywhere but Brooklyn, New York. He's lived in an apartment and then our current house his whole life. I didn't have a family house. There was no place that I considered, oh, that was my house. It just wasn't attached to any place, any physical place. I mean, I've lived in New York now. I moved here in 89. So I've lived here longer by a factor of, but let's see, the longest place I was anywhere was 4 years. So 7-8 times longer here.
Yeah.
New York is home. Brooklyn is home. For me to even comprehend, my upbringing was so totally different than his.
And you provided that stability for him.
It's not that a military family can't be super stable. I mean, yes, you may move around a lot, but if your family bonds are tight. Also, I think, you know, nowadays, it's so much easier to stay in touch with friends when you leave.
That's true. Social media.
I left, it was like, we still wrote letters because you certainly couldn't afford to make a long distance phone call. So it was letters. And I know a lot of people who bemoan the loss of the letter writing experience. And there are a couple of authors who do these letter writing things where they offer the opportunity, if you write them a letter, they'll write you a letter. And there's a lot of people who do still like to write letters.
Me and my girlfriend, we write letters to each other and we mail it, even though we live with each other, we still mail it out. So we receive it. I mean, hey, aww, go on for the romantic points, right? I also write to best friends. When once in a while I know they're not, like, kind of feeling down, I'll send either a book to pick them up with a good message and write a note with it, or just write a best friend letter. I'm all about that old school writing letters situation. I'm all about it. I agree. I am sad that's gone away. But for you, having that as your main point of contact, keeping in touch with your friends in the past when you were moving around, I'm kind of jealous of that. I just wish people would do that more often.
I love instant communication. I really, really do. I do.
I get overwhelmed. I'm like, calm down. It's giving me anxiety.
Your email inbox can always be a little daunting. Sometimes the texts make your phone buzz so hard it falls off the table. Yes. But I really like being able to instantly communicate. And I'm terrible at waiting. It's the one part about agenting comes with the job, is a necessary part of the job. And I hate it. I'm just, no. Waiting stinks.
I think that's awesome for your clients. Maybe it's because I come from an acting background and there's a lot of actor friends who are always, oh God, my agent's taking forever to get back to me. So at least you're not one of those.
Plus you wait in an audition line. You wait for a response about the audition.
Exactly. Hello, what's the feedback? Did my actor suck or was she great? What's happening? At least you're one of those is responsive, it sounds like, to your clients. But it just sucks that you have to wait on the other end to give them some type of feedback.
They all know that sometimes I get super busy and it's easy to fall behind. They all know that they can poke at me and eventually yell at me if I don't get back to them.
Where in Brooklyn are you in?
I'm in Park Slope, along with most of the rest of publishing.
I was going to say, a lot of people are in Park Slope, a lot of authors as well. Do you like Japanese food?
I do.
Have you ever had Japanese breakfast?
I'm not sure.
Japanese food is not all like sushi and raw food. They have like izakaya and all that stuff.
Sure.
But then they also have breakfast. There's a breakfast spot called Okonomi, and it's in Williamsburg.
I love it. It's the middle of a neighborhood. You would have no idea out of nowhere. You're just like walking, driving, or biking by. Boom, there's a restaurant. Looks like it's part of a home, and it only seats about 10 people at max.
Okay.
And there's always a line, but they open at 10 a.m. Of course, right? We get the whole plate of super clean grilled fish. It's all about simplicity and focusing on only the necessary ingredients. And then they have their pickled Japanese side dishes as well that come with it. And
sure.
then like this
yeah.
delicious red rice and soup. I love Brooklyn. Now going back, so you went to school and then right after that you moved straight to New York. So what brought you out to New York?
My dad was born and raised in the Bronx. Never had a kind word to say about New York the whole time we grew up. I think we visited New York once, only once that I can remember. I think I was probably somewhere between 10 and 12. The only real strong memory I have of that trip was my mom took us to see Grease on Broadway, and she dragged us out at halftime because she was so upset by the foul language. That was the only thing I can really remember about that trip at all. My dad, he did not love New York. And again, following the whole college thing, I was like, well, if I go to New York, they won't visit me. My journalism degree was an emphasis in magazine journalism. And as my final project for that, I had created a full color illustrated science fiction magazine. And so I was like, we'll move to New York and get a job with a science fiction magazine. Again, note my previous comments about doing no homework, no research, and not having resources. At the time, the two biggest were Analog and Asimov's, and they basically had staffs of two, and nobody was going nowhere. So I got here, and that was a slightly rude awakening. And at that point, I started talking to publishing companies, to book publishers, that ultimately I still was looking in fantasy and science fiction, couldn't find a job. Finally had an interview with the woman who would become my first boss out here, Donnie Forrest, at Dutton Children's Books. And I had never thought about children's books as a career or as a future or really as anything except for something I read when I was a kid. And the interview went great. I really liked her. We really hit it off. I was definitely reaching the end of all of my money, so it was time to do something. She gave me three books to read that night to talk to her the next day. And so she gave me a copy of Mildred Taylor's Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry. She gave me a copy of Winnie the Pooh, because Dutton was the original Winnie the Pooh publisher. Mm-hmm. And she gave me a copy of William Slater's Interstellar Pig, which is this amazing science fiction novel. I read them that night, and the next day she offered me a job, and I was like, okay, I've been in children's books ever since.
I know you mentioned that you never had an interest in the children's book publishing world. Where did that interview come about?
Just like most people, when you come to New York, if I want a job in publishing, you know of sexy, visible roles. You know about being an editor. You know about being a salesperson or a marketing or publicity person. You kind of know those. You don't really know much else. There's obviously people who are smarter and savvier, who know all the other intricacies of publishing and can apply for other types of jobs there. Editing was all I knew. I'd been interviewing, putting in my application everywhere and not getting anywhere. I had an informational interview with a human resources person at Simon & Schuster, and I wish I could remember her name. She was amazing because she just took pity on me, and she sat down and talked with me about every single different department within the publishing company.
Whoa.
And what other opportunities there might be available. And one of the things she described was subsidiary rights, which I'd never, ever heard of in a million years. I was like, that sounds really kind of cool. I started putting down, instead of just editorial, I started putting down subsidiary rights on my applications. And all of a sudden, the phone started ringing. I still wasn't, unfortunately, finding the right job for me, but the job at Dutton was in the subsidiary rights department. And that's how that happened.
Can you explain subsidiary rights to me and any listeners that may not be too familiar with that world?
Sure. I don't remember how she explained it to me. Subrights are anything you do with a book that's everything from foreign language translations to audio to film and television to merchandise, anything that could be connected to a book that you could license rights to from that book. In those days, the primary thing for subrights departments was translation rights. In the case of children's, paperback reprint, because most of the houses that did hardcover children's fiction did not have their own paperback imprint. So you would sell paperback rights to one of the houses that did. That was the biggest part of what I did back in those days, that and foreign rights.
So now it's changed a lot.
In terms of publishing, absolutely it has. I mean, there's no imprint that doesn't have their own paperback division. Nobody sells paperback rights anymore. Now, a lot of that stuff is actually in the agent's control, not the publisher's control.
Thank you for that background and explaining what that is in more detail. I appreciate that. Now, jumping forward forward to when we were talking about when you got to Dutton. So you ended up working in the subsidiary rights department. So then from there, how long were you doing that for?
I stayed in rights until I became an agent.
Is that the normal process or steps to become an agent?
It's one path. There are multiple ways. A lot of editors become agents. Nowadays, a lot of people right out of college, they intern in an agency and they eventually work their way into becoming an agent. When I opened my agency in September 2000, at that point, agents were still kind of a rarity in children's. Children's publishing was not big business in a lot of ways. Sure, there were one or two exceptions, but for the most part, it was all sort of mom and pop like, not big advances, a lot of real handshake kind of business. I like you, you like me, let's work together. There were not a lot of auctions. Hollywood wasn't beating down the door for things and throwing money left and right. It was very much a small, small industry. Some of it started to change. In the 80s, picture books became really big and the sales were suddenly much higher than they had been in a long time. The growth of Scholastic and their book clubs was starting to impact things. Scholastic was publishing things like Babysitter's Club and Goosebumps, which were starting to become actual commercial money-making ventures. But still, for the most part, nobody was looking at children's going, ooh, I could make a lot of money in children's publishing. Then pretty much Harry Potter hit and changed everything. Before HP and after HP is a marker for a reason. At that point, it was suddenly like, oh, this is a place that a lot of money can happen. And at that point, of course, there are people who are drawn to the business who might not have been before, who may not have even heard of it because it was invisible before. Things started to change. But when I went out on my own in September of 2000, I didn't want to go out on my own. It was not my intention. I was scared of being an agent. I'd never been an editor. I wasn't sure if I knew anything about editorially working with a writer to help make their work better so I could sell it. I knew I could do the selling side of it, both the right side and the negotiating side, because I'd been doing that. All I had at that point was the fact that I was a reader, that I loved books, and I knew the kinds of things that I loved. Bottom line, that I was arrogant enough that I thought my taste would translate to other people.
You were saying that you did not mean to just branch off. So when was that jumping off point?
I was working at Orchard Books at the time. I was the rights and contracts director. I had all this background for the negotiating side of things that was going to prove invaluable as an agent. Orchard was bought. Our parent company was Grolier, and Scholastic bought Grolier. I was offered a job at Scholastic in their contracts department. Contracts was the least interesting part of my job. So I didn't want to do that. And of course, at that point, I knew all the other rights directors in town, and I knew none of them were leaving, so I knew there was no other rights job anywhere. So that was the first time I started thinking, well, I guess I could agent. That might make sense. And so I went around to all of the big agencies in town, everybody from William Morris, the big stuff that was around at the time and New York based, and none of them had children's division. I said, let me start a children's division for you. And for the most part, they all laughed at me because they were like, children's books, there's no money in that. Thank goodness that they all did that. Otherwise, I might have worked somewhere and what I built on my own might have been delayed.
So that's when you were like, okay, I should just go and do my own thing.
Obviously, I knew a lot of agents, not a lot, because like I said, there weren't that many in children's. There were maybe five or six children's exclusive agents at the time. And they'd become friends because I negotiated contracts with them while I was at Orchard all the time. Several of them had become friends. And so I talked to them and they said, well, here's what you have to do. And this is what you'll need. I had a semi-working knowledge of how I might make this work. Then I'd gotten to become good friends with Angela Johnson, who is an amazing, multiple award-winning writer. Mm-hmm. I knew because, again, did the contracts. I knew Angie didn't have an agent. I called Angie up and said, hypothetically speaking, if I were to become an agent, would you let me represent you? And she said, yes. And that was when I said, okay, Angie, I'm opening up my own agency and you will be my first client. That was how that started.
Holy moly. Oh, then you had Angie. And then how did you snowball into all the others? I mean, it was just you. You were a one-person team.
One-person shop. Yep. I was a one-person shop, I think, about 10 years. I didn't even have an assistant until, I think this is her 7th anniversary coming up, or 8th, one or the other. She worked for me a little bit freelance before that, but then she was working for a whole bunch of other writers as sort of a personal assistant for about a half dozen writers, as well as me and as well as my wife, Libba Bray. I had her basically one day a week, and I finally was like, you know what? Screw this. You want to come work with me full time? And she said yes, and she was, and she's been here ever since. And then I added a couple of other agents, and one didn't stay agenting, and the other decided to go back to being an editor. And then I was a little gun shy about trying to expand again. So it was me and Trisha just the two of us for another couple of years. And then last year, I hired Jennifer Udden, who had been with the Don Moss Agency, and she's been with me now for 14, 15 months now. And she's fantastic. She was primarily doing romance and adult fantasy and science fiction, and was just starting to work with YA. And her first YA client is Marika Nykamp, who had spent over a year on the New York Times bestseller list. So she's like, maybe I should grow my YA list. And I'm like, maybe you should.
Yeah, over here. Come hang out with me. Thank you very much.
She's got some really great romance writers. She does more adult than I do. I expanded into adult about 4 or 5 years ago, I guess. Only fantasy and science fiction. That's the only adult stuff that I do.
What brought you to expand?
It was a combination of things. Okay. And a couple of writers who are like, I might want to write an adult novel. And then also one of the agents from that first expansion had signed up a bunch of adult stuff. And a few of those people I'd really grown to like, and I wanted to keep them. So I was like, I guess I'm doing adult now.
Oh, it just naturally led you
just
to that.
Just naturally area. Evolved okay. That way, yeah. You know, back in the days, I think a real point of pride, and I think it helped attract clients, that I was children's exclusive, that I just did kids' books. And I think that very much helped me build the agency in the early days, especially. It's my interest change, and sometimes it's just a matter of someone sends you a manuscript, and you're like, well, that's not normally what I do, but I really like this, and I want to try.
Yeah, definitely so. Open up your eyes. I cannot get over the fact that you were handling and holding up your whole business for 10 years by yourself. Let's say by the 10th year that you first started, how many clients did you have?
By the 10th year, it was probably somewhere around 60 would be my guess. I think the most clients I've had at any one time has probably been 65 or 70. I don't think I've ever gotten higher than that.
How the hell were you handling all that?
It's a few things. In the early days, I was doing a lot more picture books, and, you know, picture books take a lot less time to read, you know, no less time to do the work on, but I had a picture book client. So if a whole bunch of my clients suddenly sent me manuscripts overnight, it was 10 picture books to read, not 10 novels to read. That was some of it in the early days. I also think at that point, I didn't have anything else to do. This was my only job. I wasn't doing anything else, and I would work 24/7, basically.
Were you not having a family yet?
I did. And my son was born, and my wife and I made a deal. She was incredibly supportive. We worked out that I had to be making money in 2 years and a living in 5, or I had to go back and get a job. I was very, very lucky. A lot of things went right, and I was making a living in 2.
Wow. Good for you, Barry. Now that you mention your wife, I am very curious. How does that work? Your wife, Libba Bray, is an author. I'm assuming you met through work?
We both worked at Penguin, but she was on the adult side. She worked in publicity at the time. And at the time I met her, writing novels was not something she even thought about. She was a playwright.
Oh, okay.
She was working in publishing. She wanted to write for the stage. It's what she really wanted to do. If you think breaking into publishing is hard, breaking into the theater world is 1,000 times harder. Whoa. Unless you know somebody or you've got a friend with super deep pockets who can basically bankroll a production. It's really, really tough. She was having trouble getting readings done. And, you know, it's not like you can walk in off the street and go, here's my play. You want to read it? She went to the University of Texas at Austin, and she'd done a couple of award-winning productions down there. It's a really rough world. So we'd been together maybe a year or two before I first suggested to her that she should try writing a YA novel.
Oh, okay. So you were the one who gave her the idea, or at least pushed her.
I was the one who suggested, you know what, hey, there's this whole other thing. You don't have to give this up, but you're a really good writer. There was a play she'd written that has never been produced or published or really seen by anybody that had a very YA storyline to it. And that was the first time I sat down and said, well, you know what, this might work. Libba is very, very in touch with who she was as a teenager. She's got this bizarre memory. She remembers everything. She can tell you her best friend's phone number from second grade.
What?
She can't tell you where her house keys are, but she can tell you that. But I mean, she just had this great voice of a teenager in her head. And when she wrote, it really came through. She didn't feel at that point like she was like, well, I know exactly what I'm going to write. Friend of mine, Jeannie So, who's an editor at Chronicle now, so she's editorial director there. At the time, she worked at Bantam Doubleday Dell. And she had a paperback series that she thought Libba would be right for. It was done through Alloy. Back in that, at that time, they were called 17th Street Productions still. So Libba ended up doing a book, actually 3 books for them, ultimately, all under pseudonyms in these different series for them. And then another one for Wendy Loja over at Random House, who ultimately became her first editor on the Great and Terrible Beauty books. As she said, working for a packager is boot camp. It's boot camp for writers. She learned how to plot and write a novel. and it was a really great experience for her. And so when she did come up with the idea for A Great and Terrible Beauty, she had some experience under her belt on how to write something, but it was the first time she'd ever written a multi-book series. She'd written books and parts of other series, but she wasn't the only writer doing them. So here's one she conceived and conceptualized as a three-book series. That proved really challenging because Lib is an incredible writer, but organized is not how her brain works. Outlining and plotting and formulating exactly where you go from book one to book three was a super challenge. But the books were incredibly successful, and they put her on the map. The first book after she finished that was the bizarre and really amazing Going Bovine, which is my favorite of Libba's books, and it won a Prince Award.
Wow. Through this entire part of her writing career, you were there the entire time as her agent?
Yep, I was. At that point, it was, why give somebody else 15%? I can do this part for
you. Yeah, I could bring it back to the family. Damn.
It's like you're not really actually giving anybody a commission. So
that's right, Barry. That's the way we think. I would do the same exact thing. And also, if my hubby were a literary agent, I'm like, are you working on my book? Is there like a balance that you're able to find? For me, I don't know if it's like loyalty issues or it's just ingrained in me and my family growing up. Let's say if I were a talent manager of actors and I represented my sister, but also represented others, I would put all my heart and soul into all of my clients. But at the same time, I can't help but put an extra oomph behind my sister because she's my sister.
I think that's a normal human reaction. I think it's two things. One, I think we have a really great working relationship. She is really, really good at telling me whether she needs me to have on agent hat or husband hat. That's a big piece of it, is communication is key. All my clients know that if anybody actually asks me if I have a favorite client, I do. I married her.
That better be the answer, or you're sleeping on the couch.
That's the only right answer, right? Exactly. Beyond that, it's Libba has a deal, and now I need to work on another author's books, and then I have to work on another author's books. It's all time management as much as anything else, but I do just as much for her as I do for any other client. I do just as much for any other client as I do for her. It couldn't work otherwise. If my other client sensed that Libba got all my resources just because she was married to me, I'd probably have trouble attracting clients.
That's very true.
I would think so. I would assume that they're all smarter than that. There are a few other agent author couples out there. There are a lot of author couples, and that can be challenging in its own way, because if one of you is more successful than the others, that can present challenges. But I think it's all about, if you find that right person, you're willing to do the work because it's work, then you make the relationship work.
That's amazing. Does your son have any interest in writing?
He'll be a sophomore at Sarah Lawrence. And yes, unfortunately, we somehow went horribly, horribly wrong and did not scare him off of the family business. And yes, he wants to be a writer. So.
That's awesome. Congratulations. Why the hell is that bad news? That's awesome. Good
because,
for you.
You know, this is not an easy business.
You sound like an Asian mom mentality. Okay, we get it. Artists are going to starve. We understand. No, but this is exciting,
though. He wants to write short stories. That's the thing he likes to write. But he also really loves manga. I'm like, that's great. As long as you find some way to pay your bills, because that's a long shot, kiddo. I have tremendous confidence in him. I actually think he is a very good writer. Name the number of writers who make a living off of short stories. There aren't many. There aren't many.
Is it usually just submitting to contests and trying to maybe earn some cash prizes with that?
There's always that route and getting published in magazines and things like that. And sure, I mean, you know, George Saunders is doing pretty darn well.
Oops.
He just did his first novel, but up until that, it was all short fiction. Kelly Link is one of the most amazing writers on the face of the earth. Has a novel under contract, but still at the moment, all she has written are short stories.
Does she publish it in book format by collecting
her short
stories? She's
had a couple of collections published, but she also published magazines and things like that. That's how most short story writers, there aren't a lot of short story writers who I think go straight cold out of whatever into a published book of short stories. Their short stories have appeared in magazines or something somewhere. Gotcha. Then they're collected and then they add new ones, or there's a million and one different ways to go about that. But it's not that it's impossible. It's just super hard. Yeah. Look at the number of short story collections that are published versus the number of novels that are published. It's night and day difference.
Would you compare short stories to poetry as well?
I think poetry is the same kind of thing. Although I think, again, I actually think there are more opportunities as a short story writer to make a living than as a poet. Again, because it pays a little bit better. I mean, poetry, I don't think most of the poetry journals are throwing cash around.
Right.
If you publish a book of poetry, the best thing you can hope for, I guess, is winning a major award, and hopefully a major award that has a cash prize attached to it. You're not seeing a whole lot of poetry collections sell hundreds of thousands of copies.
That is true. It's rare. That sucks, though. I totally get your fear. I get it. It was like my mom and dad hearing when I was like, I want to be an actor. And they're like, oh my God. I think you kind of had the similar reaction for for your son. But I think that's exciting because also you never know, he could be making a killing at it. Maybe by the time he's in college, you know?
Absolutely. He could one day decide to write a novel or a play or a script for a movie. Who knows what he'll do? Well, I think it caught us off guard because he's an incredibly talented musician. He plays everything and he's really, really good. But he'd always been super clear that was art for art. And he did it because it was fun and it made him feel good. He never wanted it to be the way he made a living. And so to have him suddenly turn around and go, yeah, I actually would like art to be my life.
It's like, wait, what happened?
It was a little bit shocking.
Yeah, it's like, wait, hold on. You set us up to think this was just for art, right? But good for him. He's finding his way. It's fun seeing that you guys have inspired him in that way. Like you said, maybe he'll turn into, you know, fiction writing, novel length writing, and or the short stories together for a memoir. Who knows?
Yep, exactly.
I'm excited to check in on him and see how he's going to be doing as the years go by. No pressure. Don't worry, Barry.
Well, it is really funny how I get a lot of people who ask me if he's going to join you and become an agent at the agency. I don't think that's even crossed his mind. I don't think it's something that interests him in any particular way.
Right. I mean, if he says art for art, it doesn't sound like he would be on the business side.
Wouldn't think so.
My sister saying, I want to be an actor. I don't immediately see her wanting to be a manager or a talent agent.
Right. But it happens all the time. I mean, that's the sort of sideways way that we all end up in things.
I'm digging so much into your family and you're like so sweet about it.
Well, I'm proud of them. Why wouldn't I talk about
that? I love that perspective and that mentality, as you should be. You have an incredible family. And now moving along, I would love to know a bit more about your literary agency talk. How do you approach your relationships with your clients? And what is that like? Because I know everybody's different. Everybody likes to work a little bit more with space. Some of the clients like it when agents aren't really on their back. Others do love it when there's more attention. So how does that work for you?
There's no one size fits all. It's different for each client individually. You tailor it to what they want and need. In a more general way, I am not a super duper line editing type of editorial agent. I don't have an editorial background. I don't write edit letters for my clients. When I read their work, then we get on the phone and we talk and I tell them what's working and what's not working. And it's a conversation. And sometimes it's what's not working evolves because they're like, oh, well, is it this? Is it this? Is it this? Some of my clients have either learned that maybe having a tape recorder or learning shorthand or good skills to have when they're talking with me on the phone. For me, it's I call myself a big picture editor. I see my job as basically getting my clients' manuscripts dressed as sexy for the ball as they possibly can so that they have as many suitors as possible at the ball. That's how I go about it. I do not want to submit a manuscript that is perfectly polished. In my mind, look, there's a lot of competition out there, more now than there ever was than when I first started. Every editor I submit a manuscript to is getting hundreds of them every week. I want an editor to be invested if they buy a book from me. I want them to be invested in my writer's career. And if they just take a book and they're like, well, this is basically done, I just need to run it through copy editing and go, when they are sitting in that sales and marketing meeting and they've got their whole list in front of them and they have to talk about the book that matters the most to them, they're going to talk about the one they have the most blood, sweat, and tears in. My philosophy has always been, I don't want a manuscript that's done and dusted and ready to go. I want it so it's in good shape so you can see all of its potential.
But it's also malleable.
Yes. And then I want an editor to get in there and get their hands dirty and work really closely with my author to make it the best book possible.
Can you give me an overview of the steps just in case we have listeners who are newer to the writing community or maybe not really sure the exact steps of what happens? Most writers I know in our community are focused on querying literary agents, but I think a lot of them don't really know what really happens afterwards. Whose role is what? How do you know which editors to introduce them to? And then how the publishers come into the picture? Can you walk us through that?
Sure. So after I've signed a writer, like I said, when I started, there were only a handful of us. And more often than not, when I offered representation to a writer, they said yes. They didn't tell me, oh, well, I've got three other offers from three other agents and now I have to compare and contrast. It's kind of hilarious to me that I've ended up basically in a giant beauty contest for my career. So one of the things that now often potential clients ask me is, where would you see this going? Who editorially do you see me matching with? So I often have to do that step a little bit earlier than I might otherwise do. But for me, I come up with a list based on, I know editors, some I've worked with for 20 years, others I just met at maybe at a conference or maybe at just at drinks or was introduced by a friend. Maybe there's a young assistant who used to work for an editor I've done a lot of work with and they've just been promoted and are now acquiring. That's the database that all agents work from, is we have all these names, all these editors, and we know their tastes. And some of them we know our tastes click with better. Some editors that I have never sold a book to, there are other editors I've sold a lot of books to. I create a list of editors and houses that I think would be right for this particular manuscript. And then I send that list to my client and say, look this over. Now, some writers have never met an editor before in their life. It's not required that they have. Others have been going to conferences, have been around the block in terms of like exploring the business, may have opinions about some of the names I have. Maybe they met them at a conference and they didn't get along. Mm. Or maybe they had shown them a manuscript earlier on and they hadn't liked the feedback they got. It's a process between the two of us.
So it's a courtship, like dating.
This part is, in terms of approaching a client and trying to woo them, yeah, I guess that has some courtship aspects to it. Now I've signed them. They're my client and I'm working with them. And this is about figuring out who do I think is going to respond to this book the same way that I did.
Sorry, I meant courtship between your clients and the editors.
And initially, all that is based solely on the manuscript. If I get multiple offers, I will almost certainly every time want my author to talk to each of the editors who are making an offer, who are interested in acquiring it. Because again, I do think this is a very intimate business. If you're a writer, your manuscript's your baby, and this is someone who's going to be messing with your baby. You want this process to go right. And it is definitely a collaborative effort. Like I said, some of my clients have more experience and more knowledge of editors than others do. So they may or may not have a whole lot of input at that point. Once I've got the list and we finalize the list, and then I submit the manuscript and then we wait.
Okay. So when you say that the editors are acquiring and then they buy the manuscript, so does that mean the editor is representing a publishing house?
Well, the editor works at a publishing house.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I see. Yeah. So immediately when you have an editor, you're already attached to a publishing house then?
Yes. I'm not sending to editors who don't have the ability to actually publish work. They work for a publisher. They're an employee at a publishing company.
Okay. Interesting. Let's say if it's a brand new editor that you said you might've just met at a coffee meeting or a conference, right? But aren't really too familiar with their work, then how do you get familiar with their work?
Hopefully they're really good at talking and telling you what they like and what they don't like. And some are and some aren't. Some people are not as good at really in-person, one-on-one conversation telling you what they like. And so then you reread the things they've edited. You read what they're publishing.
Okay, so they have their own portfolio.
Absolutely, yeah.
Very interesting. I don't even know if you're allowed to even talk about this, but do you have personal go-to editors that you know you can always rely on?
Well, there are editors I certainly can always rely on.
Right.
That doesn't mean they're going to like the book I send them. There are probably a couple of editors who end up on my submission list more often than they don't, either because I've sold them a lot of work, and so I know that our tastes do tend to overlap, or because I know they're really great and I want to work with them. Sometimes it doesn't happen. I made a big fuss. A few months ago, I sold my very first picture book manuscript to Arthur Levine. Now, I've known Arthur since I started in publishing. He worked at Dial Books when I worked at Dial Books. We had offices right next to each other when we both worked at Putnam. I've known him forever. And of course, Arthur became super famous after publishing Harry Potter. He'd been an amazing editor before that, but that put him on the map in a whole different way. So I've known Arthur, and I feel like I know Arthur's tastes really, really well. I also know his list is small and he wasn't buying a lot. I very, very selectively sent things to Arthur over the years, but we just had never really connected on anything. There was one book he'd made an offer on, it ended up going to another house, but I finally sold him a picture book. And so it's my first book deal with Arthur, and it's a book I'm really excited about.
Well, congratulations.
It's a picture book. Sometimes it just takes time. It's also a matter of, look, there are economies involved. There are economics involved here. Just because an editor wants a book doesn't mean they get it, because they've got to bid against other houses. And sometimes the money becomes a factor. And I'm one of those agents who I think an editorial relationship is worth more than dollars. But sometimes the dollars are impossible to ignore. There may be that an offer of $25,000 from one editor and for $50,000 from another editor, and maybe in the big scheme of things, that $25,000 is not a huge deal because you just could click with the editor who offered the $25,000 that much more. And so maybe you as author make the decision that, you know what, no, I'm going to give up that extra money because I like this editorial relationship more. That decision becomes harder the bigger the numbers get apart. And while I would like to always say we are always picking the editor who clicks the best, and you know, oftentimes it's an embarrassment of riches. Like, okay, there are five editors who all offered significant sums of money to publish this book, and they're all fantastic. And then it's just about same as it was when my clients chose me over whatever other agents offered to them. It's who feels right, who feels best.
Got it. After you and the client discuss and they're happy with whichever editor, let's just say there are several options, then they buy it and then you wait. What happens from there?
So after a manuscript is sold, there's multiple steps. So on the business side of things, there's the whole contractual process, which can take anywhere from 3 to 6 months.
Whoa.
Think about the number of books you see on a bookshelf. Every one of those books has at least one contract attached to it. Contracts departments tend to be small and understaffed, and they have to generate all of this paperwork. If it's your first time doing a contract with a publisher, or they've just changed their basic contractual boilerplate, which, for example, like happened when the Penguin Random House merger happened, although it happened a couple of years after they finally merged together their contracts, they merged their contracts together. At that point, we had to sort of start from scratch. Once you've done a deal with a company, with a particular publisher, now you've got what's called a boilerplate. You've got a standardized agreement between your agency and them. So you don't have to negotiate everything. So it goes a little bit faster. The contractual side of things takes time. Meanwhile, simultaneous with that is the editorial process. The editorial process, for the most part, does not involve the agent anymore. Mm-hmm. Now it's between the author and the editor. I'll get involved if there's a problem or if my author needs me. But ideally, at that point, the two of them are working on making the manuscript the best book it can possibly be.
I see. I don't know if this is common, but do you ever jump in and be like, hey, so how's the process coming along? Can I read, let's say they're 6 months into editing with each other. Are you able to just jump in and say, hey, can I have a look at what you have and see the changes in process and progress?
I could always ask, but I don't really need to. It's too many cooks in the kitchen. If a client wants me to read something because they're unsure of something or if they're having any issues with their editor, I will always read. I'm always excited about my client's work. Yeah, if they've got an editor and an editorial relationship in place, I don't need to be muddying the waters.
Gotcha. Very interesting. Now, backtracking, when do you know you have a feel of, I love this person's work and could be a great potential client? What stands out to you when you're looking at their manuscript?
Oh, there's so many things. Sometimes it's language. Sometimes it's out of the ballpark plot that just wows you. For me, it's almost always character, though. I'm definitely much more of a character-driven person than I am about plot-driven work. It's not that I don't appreciate plot. I want a book to have a good plot. For me, it's all about the characters. It's all about the heart and soul of these people that I want to get to know and love or hate. When I meet a character on the page that just is someone I want to know everything about, that I know I've got something.
And how often do you usually come across that kind of work?
Not very often. It's pretty rare.
Can you give me an idea of how many submissions you get?
I get at least 100 a week.
Damn. You have time to read through every single one?
I do. I read all my queries myself. Briefly, I had an intern last fall, the first person I've ever trusted enough to pre-read for me.
Okay. And how was that with the workload?
It helped. She was an intern. It was temporary and she didn't stay. And so okay. I'm back to square zero. So I'm always behind. I mean, that's just the nature of the beast. Because obviously, if a client sends me a manuscript, queries are the lowest priority. They're the last thing we do. There's always a million other things to get done. There's tons of other work to do. So queries are the last thing we do. It's not that we don't want to find things. I'm hungry to find something. I always make some time for it.
Understandable.
Back to when I first started, all I was doing was reading manuscripts because there was nothing else to do. I didn't have any books to sell. I didn't have any contracts to negotiate. I was basically a blank slate. All I did was read. And every once in a while, I miss those days.
Well, that's a good change right now. So congratulations to you on that. I do have two listener questions that are in the same ballpark of what I just asked you. So Erin Latimer, she's asking what is selling well in the market now and what isn't? And do you have a prediction for future trends?
The thing I always tell anybody when they're asking what is the trend now, first of all, if you see it as a trend, it's old and over because everything you see on the shelf was bought 2 to 3 years ago. Okay. If you suddenly see, oh, look, monkeys in outer space books are really big. Look, there's five of them. They're all doing real. I'm going to write a monkey in outer space book because that's a trend. No, we bought all those. They're done. We're buying something else now. But I'm also like, you know what? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what's trendy or what's not trendy. If you write something that's really freaking good and I love it and I think I can sell it, I'm going to sell it or at least try. I mean, there's no guarantees in this industry ever. But if I believe in a manuscript, I'm going to try and find a home for it.
The second question from our listener is Gigi Griffiths. And she wants to know what is on your manuscript wish list right now and what categories are you representing and actively seeking?
My answer with this question always is, I don't know. Every time I specifically respond to a manuscript wish list inquiry with something specific, I get a whole lot of crappy versions of what I want. And it's just too depressing. I've done it every once in a while. There are two things that I've basically been looking for since I started as an agent and have never, ever come across. One is I would love a new contemporary version of Watership Down, you know, a really, really great animal fantasy that punches me in the heart and feel and brain the way that that book does. And I get a lot of animal fantasy and it's all just pretty mediocre. And I've just never found that book that was for me. And then the other thing that I'm always talking about is I really want a lesbian romantic comedy for YA. Again, it's just something that has never come across my desk in a way where it was a manuscript that wowed me and I loved everything about it and I love the characters. And I keep looking and maybe one day I'll get it. I hope I will. But it hasn't happened yet. So, but in terms of what I'm looking for, I'm looking for something that'll wow me. You know, I'm looking for something that I haven't seen before. I'm looking for something that makes me feel all the feels. And that can be anything from a picture book up through an adult novel. On the adult side, like I said, I only do fantasy and science fiction. In kids, in middle grade and YA, I do any genre, anything. I don't rep a lot of nonfiction, although I have a new client who writes a lot of nonfiction. So I will be doing some more nonfiction in my future. Mostly the thing with nonfiction was always that it wasn't something I read. And so I don't feel like I have the same kind of working knowledge of it that I do other types of things, other genres. My first few years as an agent, I used to always say, if someone could write me the YA equivalent of Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, I would totally be interested in representing that. I have no idea what that would even look like. I still to this day have no idea what that would look like. That would be something that would definitely push all my buttons.
You have still not come across a good lesbian YA romantic comedy. I think there's a lot of important talk about diversity and being authentic in the way you write, what you're writing. As a literary agent, is it something that's really important to you that whoever writes this amazing young adult lesbian romantic comedy, that the author herself truly a lesbian?
I do. And it's a tricky question. Obviously, I want to make sure I give the opportunity to as many marginalized writers as I can. They have traditionally been shut out of the conversation, and I would love to open the door for as many of them as I can. That said, there is going to occasionally be someone who just is a really great writer and really writes something. Then I have to weigh the pros and cons of, okay, this is not an own voices. I know that hashtag became a thing and there's been a lot of talk recently about how it's sort of been weaponized against a lot of writers now too. So I'm trying to move away from using it. I want writers who do the work. If you're going to write something that isn't your experience, you damn well better get in there and get it right. Because if you get it wrong, you are going to look bad and you're going to do more harm than good.
Thank you for that, Barry. I appreciate the honesty. I would love to step aside and ask you, what is the most difficult time in your life? It doesn't even have to be related to your career, but you were able to get yourself out of it. Can you walk us through that moment?
It's actually fairly easy. So I sort of told you a little bit about the transition from University of Illinois to University of Kansas, but yeah. I didn't tell you why. If you've been to my website, you probably have read one version of this story. I spent my entire life, I wanted to be an astronaut. And fourth grade, I got glasses. And so that ended that dream. But being in my clever fourth grade mind at the time, I thought that if I learned how to design and build a spaceship, I could go on it because I wouldn't tell them how to start it otherwise. That was sort of the framework upon which I built the rest of my life. So I was an aerospace engineering major when I got to the University of Illinois. I wanted to work in the space program. I wanted to build a spaceship. I wanted to go into outer space. This childhood dream never really completely went away. And so it really was the thing that drove me to this. I got to the University of Illinois and two things. So the first thing was my first semester there, I nearly failed physics, which was bad. And B, we had to take a lecture course, a 1-credit-a-week lecture course, where they brought in professionals from the industry to talk to us about what they did, which should have been really super interesting and awesome. It's like, oh, this is how it can be practically applied to actually making a living and doing something in the world. And I would say that in my memory, at least 75% of the people who came in and talked to us were working on weapon systems, which was not okay with me. So I was already sitting here going, okay, that's two strikes. I'm in trouble here. What do I do? But I'm like, no, this is my dream. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to figure it out. But then that January of 86, Challenger blew up. And I was watching with friends. We were all in the common room watching, and we watched this happen. And at the same time as I'm sitting here going, oh my God, these people just lost their lives, I also was thinking, oh my God, I just lost my life. I was basically like, that's the end of the U.S. space program. I really, really was convinced at the time 100% that the U.S. space program was over. I didn't think it would recover from that. And, you know, if you look around today, certainly in terms of manned spaceflight, it pretty much did end. The shuttle program is gone, and we keep talking about going to Mars, but there's not really any money or effort being put into it. And we're nowhere near getting ready to actually truly explore space, at least not manned spaceflight. At the time, it was definitely the right decision, but I was very much like, oh God, I have no idea what I do now. That was really one of those moments where this was my entire life's direction. And I was rudderless. I had no idea what I wanted to do. I went to the University of Kansas because it was cheap. I'd spent pretty much all my savings going to U of I. Figured I'd take classes. I didn't want to drop out of school. See if there was anything else that fired up my imagination and my passion and my interest. I sort of fell into English as a background just because I'd always been a reader. I'd always loved reading. That was always something I did. And taking English classes is easy enough. I kept taking a lot of math courses. At one point in time, I thought I'd actually be a math major.
Oh, wow.
I didn't really want to teach. And my imagination was probably much more limited since it was still dabbling. I hadn't done any research about what other things there might be that I could do with math. So there's the William Allen White School of Journalism at Kansas. It's a world-renowned journalism program. And I can't even remember what initially got me in. Like I said, I'd always been a reader of the science fiction magazines, and they had a magazine emphasis program, but it was journalism. And that was not something I wanted to do. I was never interested in being a reporter, short form or long form. It wasn't something I wanted to do. But when I talked to one of the teachers there, it felt like it was creative enough that I'd have room to sort of do the thing that I wanted to do. And so that's why I ended up there. And at that point, I also had enough credits for the English degree that I was like, all right, might as well get that too. So I ended up with the dual degree. Was that transition period, that summer between freshman and sophomore years, was pretty hard because I really was flailing. I didn't know what I was going to do. But it worked out pretty darn well.
It worked out amazing. But I had no idea about that. Do you do anything on the side when you have time? I really don't even know how you have the time because you're running such a crazy busy business. Do you do anything that keeps you in touch with that original love you had?
I'm certainly watching what Elon Musk is doing and with SpaceX, because obviously that's one of the more exciting ventures going on right now. The idea that if NASA isn't going to do it, then entrepreneurs could actually do it, that
which
it's become
is
feasible,
yeah,
is kind of exciting and interesting and scary too, sure,
yes,
because anything could be. Whenever there's a new planet discovered that might potentially have life, again, I work in fantasy and science fiction. It's sort of a big thing. We kind of pay attention to that stuff. If we ever actually do discover aliens, boy, it's going to change everything.
Hell yeah, it is. Oh my gosh. Do you mind if I could wrap it up with three quick questions? These are rapid fire questions. So just spit out whatever you have. So number one, tips on writing query letters.
Short and sweet, to the point. Don't start with a question, because if I can answer no, you've already lost. And do not spend so much time. Too many writers, especially new writers, spend hours and hours and days and weeks and months on their query letter. Spend that time on your manuscript. It's much better served.
Usually, do you expect them to already complete the manuscript?
No. If you're querying an agent, you better have a complete manuscript, because if I ask for it and you don't, you're off the list. I'm done with you.
Oh, damn. Barry getting all snappy up in here. Yes.
There is nothing more frustrating. If it's not done, what good is it to me?
That's true. All right. Number two, what are some manageable steps you'd advise writers to take every week towards accomplishing their writing goals?
Set them. I think it's important to set realistic goals so that you can meet them, so you can do it, and you can say, look, I accomplished something. You can check something off. I think it's really important to always feel like you're moving forward, even when you're not, because Lord knows it's not a straightforward process. And sometimes you write 10,000 words and then you have to get rid of 9,000 of them. It's not uncommon at all. So I think it's just really important to stay committed and focused and keep your eye on the end point. That's what you're after.
Love that. You've been to writing conventions and retreats. Have you ever scouted clients by doing that?
I have met clients through cons. Absolutely. Either an introduction or a relationship that ended up leading to somebody else. I think there's only one time where I signed a client from an actual manuscript that I critiqued at a conference.
Now knowing that, this question would apply. Are there any conferences or retreats or anything like that that you recommend for our listeners to check out where you had a good success rate?
Here's the bottom line. If you're going to a con to meet an agent, you're doing it wrong. What I think is important is conferences serve two purposes. One, to learn craft and to improve your craft, and B, there are social connections that could further your career one way or another. But with the first one, I think that you can totally focus on finding a place that teaches craft well. And there are lots of them, and they depend on the writer. I think one of the most amazing that a writer, especially a short fiction writer, can do is go to one of the Clarion workshops, which are amazing programs. They are super intense. They're really, really time and energy, emotional investment intense. For the right writer, they can be incredible door-opening opportunities. I think on the second one, if you go in, if your whole point, like I said, is if your point to go to a conference is, I'm going to meet an editor, an agent, and get published, that's not what it's for. And you're going to end up ultimately extremely disappointed.
Okay. And last, final question. Give us 2 to 3 places that you recommend that we need to stop by to check out food or drinks in New York City.
Oh, wow. Well, the best ice cream in New York is Ice and Vice.
Oh, what? Where is that?
It's Tribeca. Yeah, I guess that's technically Tribeca. And they partner with, I'll add the disclaimer that this is a friend of mine, but they partner with a pie shop by my friend Megan Daly, who opened her pie shop just over a year now. It's called Daly Pies. And that's over here in Brooklyn, over in Prospect Heights. But they do a lot of collaborative stuff. They're both really amazing and they do amazing stuff. And when you put it together, it's even better. There's that.
Oh my God, I'm literally looking at their website and I'm like drooling here. Oh my God, they have a flavor called Mahjong, jasmine tea, white peach, peach, lambic, sorbet. That is so funny. Nuts of Wrath. Oh my God, they sound so good. Okay, sorry. Yes. Now second.
All right. If I had to pick an absolute favorite restaurant in New York, unfortunately right now they are closed for renovations, but 11 Madison Park is the best meal I've ever eaten in my life.
Girlfriend went to that and she said it was the best, most intuitive service ever because she trains all of her employees for the restaurant service. So she's always all about observing how other restaurants teach their staff. And she said that restaurant, hands down, she mentioned something that she liked something of theirs, the seasoning or something. And one of the waitresses came out and like gave her a whole list of the ingredients on how to make it or where to get it or something like that. And she was just blown away.
That doesn't surprise me at all. I think that's sort of the philosophy behind what they do. They're reopening this fall. I can't wait to go back.
Barry, you've been so awesome. I loved having you on the show. I love talking with you. And I'm so excited for listeners to hear your episode.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This has been a lot of fun.
And that wraps up our episode with Barry Goldblatt. Barry, it was so awesome having you on the show. Thank you for such an insightful and eye-opening discussion. And I always love meeting fellow foodies. Storytellers, thank you for listening, and please hop on over to Twitter and say hi to Barry at Barry Goldblatt, and head over to his show notes page for all the books and resources he mentions in his episode over at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Barry-Goldblatt. If you enjoyed Barry's episode or learned cool new things from it, I would love to ask you for your support in taking a moment to subscribe to 88 Cups of Tea on iTunes and leave a rating and a review. Producing a podcast takes a ton of time, and we put a lot of heart and soul into making 88 Cups of Tea the best that it can be. When you take the specific actions of subscribing, leaving a rating and a review, that really helps our show become more visible to new listeners who haven't heard of us before, and we're really trying to get the word out about our podcast. Thank you so much for helping us grow our community. Don't forget to join our private Facebook group if you want to hang out with fellow writers and fellow listeners from 88 Cups of Tea. I'm so excited to see you in there. You can find us at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. Have an amazing rest of your week and I'll catch you in the next episode.
Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye.